From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, June 11th. I'm John Myers from KQED. You're praying over there.
Well, this is our Flag Day podcast.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, it's my grandmother's birthday. Sorry. Now you've just totally got me off track. That's Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. And Juliette Williams, political reporter for the Associated Press, is here to keep us honest.
Here to class it up a bit.
Yeah, exactly. A bit. Yeah. A lot. As we go over primary election results, a bit of a postmortem. It was so yesterday.
So yesterday.
And if you don't know
what are you talking about, John?
I was going to say, if you don't know what that means, that was Carly Fiorina's comment in an open mic on Wednesday about Barbara Boxer's hairdo, that it was, quote, it's quote unquote, so yesterday.
Which I thought was a little sneaky of CNN to post because it was like pre-interview, getting her makeup done.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of interesting.
It is. Although I don't really think it hurts Fiorina in any kind of way because,
no.
I mean, like, you know.
But it hurts Boxer and her feeling.
Does it?
Her one feeling?
Yes. A singular feeling. No, that's not. Anyway.
In fact, for the rest of this podcast, you can call me ma'am.
Instead of senator.
Yes.
Okay. Yet another YouTube clip being referred to here on the podcast. For an audio podcast, we're talking about random pieces of politics. Okay. So let's start at the top, if there is a top. Let's start at the race for governor. Meg Whitman's, what's the appropriate term, shellacking of Steve Poizner?
I think that's an appropriate term. Yes, I guess money does trump all.
You think so? I mean, talk about it. What do you think the message of that race is?
Well, she clearly ran an organized campaign, the kind of campaign that you can buy when you spend $81 million and you have every consultant in the nation working on it. I mean,
and could have been more than $81 million. We'll find out for sure, but yeah.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. I'm sure it will be more than $81 million. I mean, Steve Poizner just never gave anyone a reason to vote for him. You know, he had some successes by undermining Whitman on her Goldman Sachs ties and her spending and her lack of voting, but then he never provided any reason beyond illegal immigration, if that was your one vote issue, for why he would be better.
What do you think, Sage of the
Sage of
the West?
That's absolutely right. And I think already we see Whitman going on the air today, Friday, technically going on the air with her first general election ad, and it's a positive ad. She's trying to sort of scrub herself clean of the residue of that primary campaign, mm-hmm. which really was
illegal immigration.
Well, all of it, there's no mention of amnesty in this new ad. There's no mention of, you know, there's a lot of stuff.
The banner over the I was at the election night thing for Whitman. There were these great big banners all over the room, and the one that said the one over the top of the stage said jobs are on the way.
Yeah.
And what I wanted it to say was no amnesty, period. But
and something tells me we might not see Pete Wilson for a couple of months. Just call it a hunch.
Yeah.
Except for maybe on Spanish language radio on Jerry's behalf.
Yeah, I was going to say on behalf of the union.
Absolutely,
or
you'll see it there. Yeah.
Well, let me stop. I'm talking about Poizner for a minute. Let's kick at the
so yesterday.
Right. See, that just permeates everything here. But I mean, let's kick at the, no offense, Steve, let's kick at the carcass just for a moment. And try to, I mean, you know, because this is going to be one of those great stories of a guy who spent $25 million or so. I mean, you know, which is usually a lot of money, except as you said, Juliette, you know, when you get $80, $100 million, who knows what she spent. You know, like by the time the primary day came and went, but he spent all of this money, and I still am somewhat baffled by the campaign strategy. You and I almost got into a postmortem last week, and then we said, "No, let the voters weigh in before we start talking about this." Let's talk about it now. I'm baffled by the campaign strategy in a lot of ways because almost everyone I've talked to, and I haven't asked either one of you this, but I asked a few people over the course of the last couple of weeks. I said, "What do you think the most effective ad was in that race?" And they all said the same thing, and I agree on this ad, so I'm putting you guys on the spot. What do you think was the best ad from the Poizner campaign?
The voting ad.
Okay. That's one. That's not the one. But that's part of my point.
I'm not a big TV watcher.
The Vulture. I think the Vulture ad was the most. Let me just finish my thought here for a moment.
We'll get to it, will you?
If you might. I know. It was a long setup. Come on. Hey, I'm driving the show here.
Apparently.
I like to hear myself talk. That's what my mother would say. No, but I thought the Vulture ad was probably the most effective, pointed ad. It raised an issue about Whitman's character, about her time as a CEO. They go all of these things that are the fundamentals of what her campaign were about. And the voting one, too, I would say. You know, they also go to character. And those ads were up for so little time.
Absolutely.
The whole campaign was illegal immigration. It was this Hail Mary on an issue that even the polls at the end showed the voters didn't believe Whitman was – I mean, sorry, didn't believe Poizner was the guy whose idea they backed on that.
Well, I think going back to Juliet's more concise and clear point.
Yes. That's why we have her here.
Even that Vulture ad didn't give people a reason to vote for Poizner. It was all anti-Whitman.
Yes.
Exactly. And if you care enough about illegal immigration, if that is your one issue in the midst of this battered economy, the state budget mess, all these other issues that California's facing, then you probably voted for Steve Poizner. But beyond that, I mean, I think most voters and even Republican primaries voters are going to look at the whole big picture and probably looked at who was a viable candidate.
Well, and I didn't mean by my long stem winding conversation there that you know I thought the whole campaign should have been, you know, the Whitman attack campaign. I mean, yeah, he needed to put a forward a more of an idea of why to vote for him. But just when you're contrasting or when you're going to do the negative ads, I you know, the illegal immigration stuff and trying to say she was like the president of Mexico and Obama, it never felt like it was going anywhere.
Yeah.
And again, there was never any data. I mean, you talked to a lot of people, Anthony, about private polling. There was never any data that he was getting a huge lift out of that. The gap closed, but the gap could have closed too because her credibility came down in the wake of the Goldman Sachs stories and all of the other
time.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and this is going to be interesting going forward because we see Whitman on the air today with positive ads. And then this independent expenditure committee acting on Brown's behalf has promised to match her when she goes on the air, which is today, Friday, then the IE is saying that they're going to be on the air. They're going to be on the air with negative messages about Meg Whitman. And this is, you know, this is something sort of to look for the fall campaign is that people, I don't think voters make a distinction between whether the ad is coming from a group on behalf of Jerry Brown or Jerry Brown himself. And if they're going to be up all summer to match Whitman, but are they going to be up with positive messages about Brown at some points? Or is it just going to be negative stuff on Whitman? Because I think there's a danger of going exclusively negative. I mean, the tenor of that campaign, just reading a lot of the commentary about it, and you look at the voter turnout, which was a record low on Tuesday.
Yeah.
That, you know, it didn't seem like a very well received campaign. You know, wasn't a real feel good campaign. And so, I think there's a danger for this IE now acting as a surrogate for Brown. If Whitman's going to be out there putting up a positive message, at what point do we begin to see Brown or his allies start to outlay a positive vision? Jerry Brown's positive
or
vision
any
for
vision.
The future. Right.
Let's be real. Jerry Brown hasn't put out there very much of what his plan is or what his counter is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're, you know, you can't just run on, look, I can handle it. I'm the senior statesman. I don't think that's going to.
Well, it's interesting. And this is something that I was writing before we started the podcast. Hopefully I'll get it up online before. But it does go to this issue because in listening to Brown's post-election press conference, which I was at on Wednesday in L.A., and I kept asking him, because I'm the pain-in-the-butt guy who covers the budget, about specifics, you know, about these kinds of issues.
Good luck.
And there's a political calculation here. I mean, no doubt. The political calculation is the longer you wait, or that you can wait before us in the press continually over, you know, really beat you up on it. But the longer you can wait to do that, and the more you just leave the Whitman campaign to sift through your past, I think maybe they might think the smaller target he is. I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, he's not a small target anyway, given his past. But I guess what I'm saying is he can always say that was me before. That's not me.
He is
now.
Very good at that.
He is very good at that. But
is.
I was going to say, but I do think, you know, I want to give him a small amount of leeway on this issue, because the more he kept talking, the more it seemed like to me that one of the first fundamental things the voters have to discover about this race is that they view leadership very differently. You know, Whitman's approach to leadership so far is the policy book. And it's also not that. It's the I want to bring the legislature into working teams. I'm going to veto bills that aren't on the point of my three things. And Brown's comments are, I want to get up there, roll up the sleeves, bring everybody in, tee up the issues, and let's see what we can figure it out.
Yeah.
And those are different styles
totally
of a CEO who has had a path toward, I'm laying out what we're going to do, let's go, let's go, let's go. And Brown, who maybe has learned by mistakes in the past, I mean, you know, some people could say it, but not to make those kinds of things. And maybe he genuinely wants to, you know, to call all 120 legislators and say, what the hell are we going to do?
Probably does.
Et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I mean,
well, and Whitman has said she would move to Sacramento and that she would do more than Schwarzenegger did on reaching out to lawmakers and things like that.
Right. They're not mutual.
She's had to make those concessions to mitigate the corporate
CEO. They no doubt are mutual. Yeah. They're not mutually exclusive. But, I mean, they are, you know, they are contrasting viewpoints, I think, of what the job is and how you do it. And
And let's face it, Jerry's campaign strategy for the primary worked beautifully. There was clamoring early on when Whitman was up 30 points at the beginning, like, where's Jerry? He, you know, this is already the general. And he just said, no, they're going to fight it out. They'll get sullied and just back off everyone. And
well, because Mike Murphy was right. Remember the email from the Whitman strategist?
The infamous email.
Right, to the Poisoner pollster.
The FBI. Yes. And how is that FBI investigation going?
Well, let's ask Jerry.
Who's checked in lately?
Or the Attorney General investigation.
Yes.
But that essentially, I mean, what we saw this movement in the polls, and some of this was inevitable anyway, but as soon as somebody started hitting Whitman, her numbers were going to move down against Brown. I mean, she had an early lead on Brown back in January. The most recent polls show her.
We're talking about Poisoner hitting her.
Well, right. And so now it just happened to come from Poisoner during the campaign. And we now see the polls give Brown a 7 to 8 point lead at this point. I mean, not that polls are worth much.
The Rasmussen poll actually has him at 1 today. 45-44. Sorry, on Thursday.
That's Rasmussen.
Fair enough. I know. I mean, grain of salt to all polls, but nonetheless.
Not the field poll, the most respected poll in America. Congratulations to the field poll.
Yes. But anyway, but let me go back to the Poisoner campaign for a minute, and then we'll talk about some other races, not just the governor's race here. But there was this great big discussion, talk about clamoring about where is a response or where is a something. The real one first was Poisoner. Is he going to go up on the air? Whitman's on the air. She's spending all this money. When's he going to go? When's he going to go? You know, in retrospect, he did wait too late.
Absolutely.
Now, whether it would have changed things, whether he would have matched her, could have matched her dollar for dollar, I don't know what his family was willing to spend on the race.
Not dollar for dollar.
But the question is, you know, and this is one of those things we've seen it in other races historically, too, about, you know, when somebody goes out front, and it's like a marathon or something, right? You know, when somebody breaks from the pack and runs further, I'm using a running analogy because I used to run before I got old and gained weight. Started podcasting and whatever. But when somebody breaks from the pack, do you go chase them or not? Or do you assume that the ebb and flow and everything is going to work back in your favor? And it didn't work for Poisoner. I mean, she built up this narrative of who she was or what she was doing or him. And that's actually the worst part. She built up a narrative about him that he had trouble dialing back.
Well, and even if we can go back to Poisoner's ads, though, even when – I mean, I don't know. I'm not a political consultant being paid $100,000 a month, but
you're thinking about it now.
I don't know if it ever could have worked from waiting that long. But even when they did launch, they launched with that weird car flying off a ledge commercial.
Where it seemed like he was
and
holding
Steve
the car.
Poisoner walking out in. Was he wearing a jean shirt?
I
mean,
about that one.
It was bizarre. And then, as you say, two of the most effective ads, they barely ran. They left him up a very short time. So I don't know that when they did decide to strike that they hit the mark.
And Democrats aren't going to cede the summertime to Meg Whitman. You know, Brown has about $20 million in the bank. His campaign is basically funded for about two months of TV. That's going to be the Labor Day to Election Day campaign. In the meantime, over the summer, we're going to see this proxy campaign, this independent expenditure campaign. That will be the de facto Brown campaign for the summer. And, you know, I mean, you look back at what happened in 2006, right after the Democrats came out of this bruising primary. Remember, Steve Wesley spent, I believe it was $40 to $45 million, a bargain at today's. You know. Well, actually, I mean, he spent $20 million more than Poisoner to lose his primary.
To Phil Angelides.
Right. But then the Schwarzenegger campaign and the Republican Party came up with ads hitting Angelides right away.
Right away.
And Angelides just never recovered from that. I mean, and Democrats are committed to not allowing that to happen again this time. So I think that, you know, now's a good time to own a TV station. If you're in the TV station owning business, you're gonna get some attention from Democrats and from Whitman, who's it looks like the ad wars are continuing throughout the summer.
And I do wonder, just on Brown really quick, I do wonder how long you can go without a more specific vision of what you think you're going to do, even if you believe there are other attributes to the job. How long can you keep doing that?
Well, does mean that Whitman's 42-page brochure, whatever it is. I subtracted the ads.
Whether that qualifies
no,
as
that
substantive?
No, that'd be yeah. 10 then.
But I mean, is that a specific vision? Is that the bar that we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, who knows? It depends on any particular pundit or columnist or someone writing. I don't know. But I guess my question is, how long can he keep the path he's going on that issue? Without giving them fodder for something else. And also, too, like the very first day out, there was, the Brown campaign said, major campaign announcement.
Which
is the same way the Poisoner
warning,
people,
warning to
which
all
is the
reporters.
Same way the Poisoner people got us into that press conference about we're pressing charges against Whitman for this, trying to get us out of the race. And it was, I challenge her to 10 town hall style debates.
And a duel and a coloring contest. And a pull-up contest.
And again, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt of saying, maybe more substantive discussions are good for the public. But that's also it. Just also felt like a gimmick I had seen before.
At the Democratic convention,
right? The three-way debate.
Let's have a debate.
So yes. I just wonder. There is going to be a certain point where. You want to see what else he's going to say, is going to happen.
Maybe she should take him up on his offer for 10 town halls and say, and she can turn around to him then and say, look, what's your plan? What are you proposing, Jerry?
Yeah, I think, that's Jerry's idea to get some free media for the summer. I mean, she's going to be carpet bombing with ads and he doesn't have the money to compete. So let's get me in the news 10 times, and get me to be part of the story. I mean, that's. And that's why we saw the Whitman campaign reject that very generous offer from Brown on Wednesday.
Maybe he'll dribble out his policy plan in a similar way to get little bits of media attention all summer.
Because policy plans,
they're riveting.
They're
it's true.
Well, a campaign where everybody is talking about debates early on is our transition to the U.S. Senate race, which is not so yesterday quite yet. Sorry, last time for that quip. But is the Boxer Fiorina matchup for the fall with Carly Fiorina winning the primary over Tom Campbell and Chuck DeVore, where Boxer, and you just think of, the conventional wisdom politics 101, you're the incumbent. You don't debate the challenger. You don't debate the challenger unless you're really worried about the direction of the campaign. Polling shows you're in trouble, which all of these things have talked about with Boxer potentially. And then you, Boxer, the 18-year incumbent, offer to debate Carly Fiorina, the newcomer candidate, right out of the bat. And
right
Fiorina said, let's do it anytime, any place.
Until October.
Right, exactly.
Now
we'll get into this negotiation stuff. But anyway, that was an interesting dynamic right out of the
Maybe they'll
right
do it on Hannity. No? Why would you do that?
Right. You got to watch the clip, I think, if you want to see this.
Maybe you should post a link.
Fiorina's open mic when she was going to be on CNN. So let's talk about the Republican race. So Fiorina, decisive win over Campbell and DeVore. That race really just changed. I mean, who knows? Was it the relentless attacks on Campbell as being too moderate/liberal in the minds of some? Was it the cementing of Fiorina's image in the ads and the robocalls from Sarah Palin? I mean, what was it?
I think money, again, is a big issue here. I mean,
Campbell didn't have the money.
Right. Yeah. Campbell didn't have money, either did DeVore, and Fiorina gave herself at least $5.5 million of her own money in addition to the money she raised. The federal reporting requirements are so bad that it's hard to track that money in real time. But I think it's a combination of things. You had sort of electability as an issue. You had Campbell, who has a problem with moderate voters. And then you had Fiorina.
Campbell has a problem with moderate
voters?
I'm
sorry. A problem, comma.
Oh.
No. Actually, bad. That's bad punctuation. He has a problem with conservative
with
voters.
With
conservative voters. And that Fiorina, was able to get her message out. I think the Palin thing was kind of the turning point. It was a boost for Fiorina, sort of shored up her conservative credentials, and she took off from there.
I heard from a lot of people that they really liked those ads and that she just came across as sort of a likable person. And, often elections come down to silly things that maybe aren't necessarily spot on about what the debate's been about. And
Right.
Well, and isn't that interesting? Because, I mean, you know, people who would see her coming across as a likable person, that's going to be one of the, that's going to be one of the things you're going to hear from the boxer camp and liberals and Democrats and others about Fiorina
sure.
not being likable as
Absolutely.
The CEO of Hewlett-Packard and all of the juicy stories that will roll out. You know, that have rolled out in the
past.
She might have
you
tailed, right? Wasn't there something at HP? It was after Fury.
Yeah, and there were the phone bugs on the
tailing reporters.
Board. Yeah. There's two books worth of fodder about her managerial style as not exactly being.
And here we only have, what, 3 months? Mm-hmm. 4 months?
But
some of that will.
I mean, it's going to be an interesting campaign. And you know, too, I mean, you know, and. You, especially when we look at the Whitman-Poizner race. I mean, Whitman had to make the case about her conservative credentials, but she never made it in the way as overt as Fiorina made it in hers.
Fiorina's more conservative than Whitman, I think.
And that's fine. But the point is that, to me, that's the bigger pivot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody talks about a pivot when you run to your party base in a primary and then you have to pivot back to the middle of the road for a general election. Fiorina's got a bigger pivot, I would argue, than Whitman has, because, I mean, she really, you know, and the Palin calls. I mean,
the
things
Palin
you will never
calls.
Hear again in a general election campaign.
Yes, you will, from the boxer camp.
Well,
yes,
from the boxer camp. And the boxer camp already trying to hit Fiorina on the abortion issue. That's a real bright line difference there. You know, Whitman's pro-choice in the governor's race, that was kind of muted, and so was Poizner. Fiorina is pro-life. And Boxer, obviously, a longtime record of pro-choice issues. So, I mean, she's got the bigger pivot, doesn't she?
Well, and the bigger hill to climb, too. I mean, the last pro-life Republican to win at the top of the ticket in California was George Duke Majan, I think, in 86.
Wow.
So you pulled that out of the archives.
Well, I'm just thinking Wilson, you know.
Sure.
I mean, they're you know, nobody else. So, yeah, I mean, not that abortion is going to be the issue in this campaign, but it's kind of code. Has been historically in California for a whole set of social issues where Californians, even the Republicans, are more moderate than their national counterparts. So,
well, and I wonder how much something like abortion resonates in the current climate where there's a lot of big issues to tackle. And you know, her record at HP will go to this too, because if she's going to base it on economics, unlike Whitman, who's by all most accounts has a pretty good record as CEO,
right.
Fiorina's
a little different.
Left it, as John Stewart pointed out last night. You know, a third of the stock dropped by a third by the time she left.
Was it 30,000 layoffs to?
If
when
you
she was
don't
there?
Have the numbers memorized, the Boxer campaign will send you a memo.
I'm sure they will.
But you know, I mean, again, this is another one of those races too. You know, if you're the Boxer camp here. How much you need to talk, or actually, let me flip that. If you're the Fiorina camp first, how much do you jab? How much is it about Boxer, and how much do you trying to sell the voters on who you are? And it seems like to me the better road for her is to beat up Boxer, is to make this a referendum on Barbara Boxer.
Well, you know, three others have tried before and failed statewide. I mean,
but none of those were, and this is credit to Fiorina, were as good a campaigner as Carly Fiorina is. I mean, likable, not likable. She has an ease on the campaign trail and talking in a way that Matt Fong and Bill Jones.
Bruce Hershenson
did not. I wasn't there for that one, but I
take
do not
my,
believe
take
he did.
My word for it. You are right.
I do not believe he did. And so, I mean, this is a very different campaign. You hear that a lot out there, but I think that's true. That is true. And then if you're the Boxer camp,
she's a girl. Don't forget.
You got to make it all about woman.
First woman. It's the first woman.
But if you got to make it all about Fiorina if you're the Boxer camp then, right? I mean, you've got to.
Yeah. I think that probably. Yes.
Trying not to. I don't
How's
know.
That for insightful?
I don't know. And of course, national issues in a Senate race play differently than they do in a gubernatorial race. They play big because there's a reason they do. The president's already been out here fundraising for Boxer. The polls, interestingly enough, at the end, you remember that one that said that Californians want a senator who will work with the president because the president's still popular?
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting place for the Fiorina camp to have to deal with, is you're dealing with a president who is still popular in California who. You need to jab somehow and have and not, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I guess we have to see how Obama's numbers hold up in California.
I mean, I think that's it. It's sort of the macro story is sort of how the title, you know, there are tsunami warnings out there for Democrats now. And we'll see what happens come November in terms of where Republicans are expected to pick up seats nationally, and whether California will sort of be what's the proper obstacle metaphor here? The bunker, the barrier against the rumored Republican tidal wave.
And just, you know, just something quickly, and then maybe we should move to a couple of other topics before we completely bore people to death on
this.
Too late. Too late. If you're still with us, you must really be bored. And that's Tom Campbell, who, you know, I don't think Campbell's career is over. Now, I don't know. Maybe his political career. Who knows? He won't do that again. Maybe he'll go back to business school. He could, you know, he's
one would help.
The guy has lots of things. But I guess I was going to contrast it quickly with Poizner. I don't know many people who think we'll see Steve Poizner in politics again. It's you think so?
The argument
that has been put forward to me, I'm just relaying things, and I think it's worth pondering. It's really hard to come back from where he was with the kind of campaign he ran, with the lack. I mean, it was a lukewarm good luck, Meg speech.
Yeah,
on Tuesday
night.
I
mean, he alienated a lot of his party base.
Yeah, it was, and also too. His biggest problem was explaining the evolution of who he was from 2004, running for the assembly, to being Mr. Very Conservative in 2010. I don't know. I mean, Campbell, I can see having a role in public life differently because Campbell, you know, pretty much said, this is who I am.
And you know, was consistent with previous.
Yeah. Campbell said, this is who I am. You know, don't mischaracterize who I am, but this is who I am. I accept it. I know I'm not like everybody else.
Yeah.
And you didn't get that feel, Anthony, you most famously saying it on a podcast one time. You didn't get that feel with Steve Poizner.
Did you say something? I can't remember.
it was a very different.
Well, and I think it started with Steve Poizner being really pissed. Like, he thought that he had put in the groundwork for this.
That may be the first time anybody's used that word on the podcast.
The inaugural
use of the word being pissed. Sorry, go ahead.
But, you
now,
know,
you've
he
both
thought
done it.
that he put in the groundwork for this race. He courted the base. He gave money. He helped finance a ballot measure. And then, you know, this rich woman sweeps in. And so I think some of what came out during his campaign, too, was this angry man mentality. And so he didn't care. Yeah. He was mad already. And so, yeah, you're right. I would be surprised if we saw him in politics.
And I'm glad you said that because I do think that's a really interesting thing that'll be historical after this. But, I mean, Steve Poizner was the only guy on the bench, quote unquote, of the Republican Party for a long time. When he won insurance commissioner in 2006, we all started saying Steve Poizner could run for governor one day. And so that became a very early dynamic there of him working the levers of the party.
Absolutely.
And all of those things. And then out of nowhere came Meg Whitman from the McCain campaign to the money, the glitz, the whatever. And
he thought those people would stick by him after having put in that groundwork, but they saw a brighter star shining.
And I can't help again on a Tom Campbell note to wonder, had Campbell stayed in the gubernatorial race, you know, what would have changed there? Because we all remember Campbell got out of that race, got into the Senate race, and Campbell looked like the guy in the Senate race. And again, I also, sorry, now I'm even veering off my point yet one more time. But again, the polls said that Republican voters thought Campbell could beat Boxer more than any of the other candidates, and yet they didn't want Campbell.
Yep.
And so this is like
a tape loop of the Republican Party's dilemma in California for the last 20 years.
But had Campbell stayed in the gubernatorial race, I don't know. It's just kind of interesting to me. I mean, would it have split some of the vote because he really would have been in the moderate?
It probably would have split some of it, but I don't know that the outcome would be any different.
Yeah, and maybe it would have made, you know. It would have provided a dimension of logic to Poizner's campaign strategy of, you know, trying to paint, if there were two votes sort of on the left, right, or two candidates to the left of him trying to peel off 35%, win with something like 35-38% of the Republican vote, would have made some sense. But I don't think the outcome would have been any different.
Yeah. I still never quite understood why Campbell switched races.
I didn't either.
The rationale for it never seemed to work for me.
Other than
political opportunism. You know, where it looked like it was an easier race to win.
Well, and
that
may have hurt him too. That may have hurt him too. That maybe people saw through that, and you know, for all his nice guy reputation, that he was another politician.
Yeah. So ballot measures quickly.
Prop 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Let's just strike 13 and probably 15. It was public financing of one campaign, but the public never has seemed very thrilled with that, except for the group of people who do believe in it. But the larger public has never seemed very interested in that, so I wasn't surprised by the outcome of that.
Nope.
14 is the big sweeping change measure, open primaries, free-for-all primaries, actually, what I feel like I should call it, because, it is a very different kind of open primary, where the parties are already talking about lawsuits, even though the exact language of 14 pretty much is the Washington State open primary and the U.S. Supreme Court has already signed off on it. So.
Yep.
Of course,
although,
that never stops anybody from filing a legal
challenge. Neither of the parties were willing to talk about it yesterday, the day after the election, talking about lawsuits. So
The Green Party was talking.
Yeah. And the third parties, you know, have their own issues. Well, again, one of the things back from my reporting on 14 is that that whole notion of the third parties really getting hurt by the open primary, like, you know, that they would no longer exist because they couldn't show their presence in elections, the way the election law works, that could be changed by statute by the legislature, of course. Whether Democrats and Republicans want to actually do something in favor of third parties remains to be seen.
Or in favor of making Prop 14 look better when they all want to overturn it.
And, of course, Schwarzenegger, great big touting this, you know, over the last couple of days, doing an interview that airs Friday morning, this morning when you're hearing this on NPR. He's sitting down with them in D.C. on his trip back there to talk about Prop 14. I think he thinks that's part of his government reform legacy.
Yeah, with redistricting
and that.
Although there'll be a referendum on that one in November. But
who would have thought that the sexy movie star governor's legacy would be redistricting reform and open primaries?
Yes. I'm sure that was why he ran for governor.
Exactly. Of course, the one thing he hasn't done a lot about that he talked about in that recall election was campaign finance. Except that he's raised an awful lot of money.
he has changed campaigns.
And then really, you know, on that awful lot of money thing, I know I'm bad on the cheesy transitions, Anthony. Uh-huh. We'll agree to that.
What now?
But lots of money, Prop 16 and 17. Prop 16, the local electricity providers got to have a two-thirds vote.
The PG&E Customer Protection Act.
The PG&E money fest.
50 mil.
Went down. Earlier in the night, it looked like it was going to pass barely. And then those votes start coming in from L.A. and other places. And the tide turned. And then Prop 17, the auto insurance discount or auto insurance rate hike, depending on which side you believed, all funded by Mercury Insurance. But PG&E, $46 million, I think, about, and Mercury, about $16 million. Mm-hmm. So, you know, $62 million from two groups to try to pass their measures that the voters just said no to. And it just, you know, goes to show that, you know, your money doesn't always work.
It's probably easier to buy a governor than a ballot initiative. Is that the lesson?
I don't know. I also don't know what to make of this for PG&E. I mean, this was quite a gamble on the part of the company. Its reputation, I think, in a lot of ways. Just kind of, you know, leaving ill will around. I even heard one person say today that, you know, some communities now are saying maybe we should have these local electricity
things. Thanks for the idea.
In which case, PG&E will have to fight it piece by piece by piece at other
and
parts of the
and
state.
They've spent millions of dollars. I mean, I think the calculation for PG&E is, look, one of these was – there was a fight in Marin coming anyway. They fought it in – was it Davis that recently had one of these fights? And they spend $30 million a pop. And so they figured if they could – get rid of all of these in one fell swoop. If there are, it would preempt these, you know, $30 million fights popping up all over the state. So now you've got one brewing, I think, in Fresno, one in Marin, and there might be some others coming. So it was a gamble, but they lost.
Yeah. It's hard to read that one on whether that means, you know, did voters see through that and were voters smarter than you gave them credit for? Or did they just go for the de facto no vote?
Yeah, I know. And I got in trouble with some listeners of the California Report.
It was Gail Kaufman's
week.
Brilliance, right?
Yeah. I got in trouble with some listeners of the California Report this week because in the interview that I did at 4:30 in the morning after the election, I shorthanded that point, Juliet. And I said something about, you know, that maybe the voters just decided it was too complicated and they said no. And I got some I don't think I even said it that artfully. And I think I got some people saying that I basically called the voters stupid. So if you listen to this podcast and you're one of those people who complained, I didn't mean it that way. But what I meant was more to what your point was. In the middle of these campaigns where they are complicated measures and everybody is spinning their own thing, the default position is to say no.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, it's safer to say no. And so we don't really
know. It's like having children. the de facto default.
Is to no. say no. Yes. I'm learning that with yes. mine. Yes. But you know, the no sides believe that they made their points, and they, maybe they did make their points. But again, when one...
There was so little money for them to get that message out
that's
there.
That's true,
though.
But there was a lot of press attention to mm-hmm. it, yes. and there was a lot of editorial writing.
You mean we still matter?
It. We might still matter. But I do, just the last thing I would say on that is, I do believe that when there's one group, when one entity is spending all the money,
yes.
I mean,
it raises
you know,
questions.
It's a red flag.
It's a yeah. red flag for yeah. a voter.
PG&E and Mercury were the only donors.
Yeah,
Chamber gave a little money.
What's that?
The Chamber gave a little money.
PG&E's a member.
Yes, to that one.
PG&E's
yeah. but
a member.
But in the Mercury insurance, when Prop 17, it was all Mercury Absolutely. Insurance when you yeah. look. And right, and so when that happens, you do, right, you said it, raise the red flag, yep. even if you're just a voter about, well, wait a minute, what's going on
Why
here?
Why are they spending all that money?
Why are they spending all... They're not doing this
to help you.
My
to
life
help you.
Better.
It's a Taxpayer Protection Act. Come on.
Yes. And there'll be much more money spent in November, I'm sure. We will have a good time with.
Indeed.
So are we done with the primary election? We close that box up? There were legislative races you could talk about.
Yeah,
we'll
have all summer.
Lines is still hanging in the balance.
Yeah, wait a minute. Wait a minute. We've got to do a couple of down ticket races. Sorry, come on. Let's have fun here for a moment. Insurance commissioner.
Bizarre.
This is we're only bringing this up because it's an oddity, right? Mike Vlines, an outgoing state assembly member, Republican,
former Republican leader,
used to be the leader in the assembly during that controversial package where the tax hike happened. Was running for the Republican nomination for insurance commissioner against a guy no one had ever heard of. He's a staffer in the Department of Insurance.
Brian
Doesn't
Fitzgerald.
Even have his phone number on his website. Didn't even raise enough money to file.
And as we sit here now,
Brian Fitzgerald.
Fitzgerald won the nomination over Mike Vlines. I don't know what you make of that. I don't know. Is that really Republican primary voters angry at Vlines?
Well, no, it's not. Because look at Abel Maldonado. I mean, Abel Maldonado was elected too. I wrote about it this week in Capital Weekly. Maybe you can put a link on your little blog there.
Maybe, maybe not.
Ballot designation is a big part
yes.
of it. You know, he was Fitzgerald's ballot designation was department's enforcement attorney. And Mike Vlines was businessman/California assemblyman. And, you know, there's such an anti-incumbent fervor, especially among Republican voters, this cycle. I mean, we saw it some other places, although Blanche Lincoln survived in Arkansas, but that's another podcast. But that there is such an anti-incumbent fervor here that a lot of legislators, I mean, Gloria Romero.
I want to talk about Superintendent for Public Instruction, the vote getter
right.
ahead is Larry Aceves.
And Larry Aceves, again, his ballot designation was retired school superintendent running
yep.
for
Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Yeah.
So on these down ticket races where you don't break through, there is no $100 million campaign going on. And a lot of voters are having their first contact with these names in the voting booth
mm-hmm.
Or when they're sitting down at their kitchen table to cast their vote, ballot designation matters in those races. And I think that the superintendent's race and the insurance commissioner's race are two examples of that.
Yeah. The other down ticket races, which we didn't mention, which were hot, but, you know, we're just all over the place here. Sleep deprivation is what I blame it for, is the attorney general's race.
Yep.
Right. The Democratic race where Kamala Harris beat back all the challengers, most notably Chris Kelly, the former chief privacy officer of Facebook, who put a lot of his own money in the campaign and didn't get anything out of it,
no.
from what I can tell. I mean, he lost handily to Harris, even though he put a lot yeah. of money in at the end, which made me think maybe he sees something in the polls that shows he can win.
And Cooley's going to be tough to beat for in November.
Yeah, Steve Cooley, the DA of Los Angeles, won the Republican nomination, and that is going to be a heck of an interesting race. Cooley,
yeah.
Harris, L.A.,
South
San Francisco.
North.
Yeah, L.A., San Francisco.
Two prosecutors.
Moderate Republican, liberal right. Democrat, death penalty issues.
Cooley is has called for changes in three strikes, unlike most prosecutors, certainly most Republicans. And law enforcement does not like Kamala Harris. You can see law enforcement play big on the Republican side here. And I think Cooley has a compelling story to tell moderates.
Absolutely.
It's kind of interesting. You look at Boxer, at least where she's from, you know, the lieutenant governor's, Gavin Newsom winning the lieutenant governor, Kamala Harris being from San Francisco, and Jerry Brown being originally from San Francisco, his family from San Francisco. You've got the top of the ticket for the Democrats. It's the Bay Area ticket.
Yeah, it is the Bay Area ticket.
And the votes are in L.A. So we'll see how that plays into this, if at all.
Of course, Whitman's from...
From Boston.
Silicon Valley.
Oh, from Long Island, actually.
Long Island.
Right. Well, Maldonado, Central Coast. Yeah,
yeah.
I know. But I'm saying it's The San Francisco liberal.
The liberal tag.
Right. I mean, that's
definitely
get ready
stick.
For it. Yeah. Get ready for it.
And the lieutenant governor's race, while it's not a job that most people care about, I think it's a fascinating matchup.
Gavin suddenly does.
I think Gavin Newsom. Yeah, exactly. A man who didn't want the
Is there a mirror?
But yeah, Gavin Newsom, mayor of San Francisco, against Abel Maldonado, the sitting lieutenant governor, ex-state senator.
Yep.
I think that's a fascinating race.
It's another one Republicans could win.
Just in terms of the images of the candidates and what they bring and all of the elements to that.
Very liberal San Francisco tag. He's the gay marriage mayor, right?
Well, and you get a twofer now. If you go over to the crime lab in San Francisco, you get to smack Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom.
And I see the clock here ticking, folks. Bear with us. Just listen a little bit longer. But you even saw at the beginning of the campaign on Wednesday morning, I mean, granted the Republican Party orchestrated this victory element, but you do see
the optics.
A strong a possibility of like Whitman and Maldonado running together because they help each other.
Yeah,
there.
Gray Davis and Cruz Bustamante.
Maldonado is boosted by Whitman's largesse of campaign money and ability to get an image out there. Maldonado and the Latino element and all of those really boost Whitman and also help her wash off the stain of the Republican primary with Latino voters.
I enjoyed that Maldonado rushed over there after his press conference with the governor in favor of Prop 14 to the Republican kumbaya.
He was a busy man on Wednesday, the day after the primary. Yeah. And I bet you, if you're the Whitman camp, one of the great things you could do is plop Abel Maldonado down in Los Angeles for weeks on end and have him, do events and do things with him.
Yeah.
And I contrast this with Brown and Newsom. Are you going to see a Brown Newsom team running together? Now, they all have an event an event on Thursday in Fremont to talk about jobs, but I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of Gavin and Jerry or Jerry.
Gavin wants in on that. He
sure
wants
he
in on that. He's already talking about, look, it's the ticket. It's the young and old.
I
don't know. Jerry's going for that.
That didn't help. Well, it doesn't help Brown.
Yeah.
It doesn't help Brown. There's no win for the gubernatorial nominee in that one. Like a Whitman, there's a win having Maldonado with
And she needs to win back some of those Latino voters that were soured in the primary.
Yep.
So we got lots of stuff to keep watching.
Yeah.
And now.
It's going to be fun.
Poor podcast listeners, we will.
Continue.
Finish.
Oh.
So Juliet Williams from the AP, thank you for
your
work, and Anthony York for not being quite as the smart aleck as you could be otherwise.
Because I'm on good behavior, Juliet.
Good behavior. Yes, right. He doesn't want to be shown up. I'm John Myers from KQBD. We'll see you next time.